time for our next comic. Very, very funny. I want you all to put your hands together for Adrian Crosby.
Hello.
Good job, Nardos.
Make some noise for Nardos, everybody. Come on, make some noise. She's right here. She can still hear you. She can see you. You're right here. You guys are the only ones fucking paying attention. You should be standing up.
It's actually Cosby, Nardos. It's okay. I avoid the rape fucking analogy every time I can. I'd rather be a Christmas singer than the richest black man in America. He's not the richest. He's just the richest rapist in America. This is really strange, guys. This is comedy. Crazy check. The alligator. Got comedians, got people not paying attention. And that's the best part, because you get to see a full fucking hour in 20 minutes. Because a comedian can go through a full hour in 20 minutes when no one's laughing. It's fucking great. One day you're gonna see one of these guys on Comedy Central and you'll be like, oh my God, I saw 5 of those jokes. Nice vest, bro. We gotta talk about the beard. How long has that been growing?
2.5, close to 3 years.
It looks like you just downloaded the wrong app. You got angry beards. This is No Shave November from 2014. Can't keep up, bro. Adrian Cosby is my name. I have to let you guys know, no relation. You don't have to cover your drink, ma'am. I'm not going to put it. It's too far away. We'll go get a cappuccino after the show. See, I'm not going to make the mistake that all the other comics made of talking to fill the time. During the period of time that you're supposed to be laughing, I'll just be silent. So here we go. It's great to be here. I drove.
Welcome back to Totally Unrelated. I'm your host, Adrian Cosby. Thanks for tuning in. We are back. I'm home in Evanston for about less than 12 hours. I'll be heading out to Toledo today. I've been in Dayton all week. Did a show last night in Mishawaka, Indiana at Evil Czech Brewery. It was a lot of fun. It wasn't the most hospitable environment. Not to say that anybody was heckling, but it was one of those shows where maybe half the people, 25% of the people, knew the show was happening and were there for it, or were willing to pay attention to it. And then there was ambient noise from the regular part of the restaurant. And then there was, you know, a good contingent of people that weren't going to be bothered by somebody talking into a microphone. But the people that were paying attention were sitting right up front by the bar. It was an elevated stage in a corner. So you could actually see the people you were performing to. You could see the people that were paying attention. And they were mixed throughout the room. But definitely had a heavy presence right up front. That was nice. And I thought watching, it looked like a miserable endeavor. But actually doing it wasn't that bad. It was a lot of fun. We were supposed to do 20 minutes. I think I ended up with my closer doing 22 when I hit end on the record button. I'm going to play some of it for you at the end of this episode. This is a special episode, guys. I have the manager of Wiley's Comedy Club, Aaron Evans. We started doing comedy at the same time, and it's an interesting story because he's still a comedian. He was a comedian before he became a manager. And I'm always reminded of the story Doc from the Dayton Funny Bone. He was telling me a story one time, and it started with him and Ryan Singer starting at Joker's together, waiting tables. Now Doc is the general manager of the Liberty Funny Bone, which is a palatial new estate that we've talked about in between Dayton and Cincinnati. And Ryan Singer is a comedian based out of L.A., very funny guy. And so it's just funny the different directions you can take when you start off knowing somebody at the beginning of a new chapter of your life. I think about the people that I met when I first started as a restaurant manager, and none of them are still in food. So, just one of those weird things that happens. I got to talk to Aaron at the club. He was pretty busy. I'm going to have to do some heavy editing to get this so that there's not like a couple 15-minute breaks in the middle of it. But we had a good talk. It's very revealing. For anybody wondering, we don't talk about anything too dangerous or controversial, but we do talk about Aaron, and I feel like I got a sense of where he comes from, what makes him tick. And clearly, if you know Aaron Evans, he's one of the nicest people you could ever meet. But I didn't know about his childhood. I didn't know about his growing up. I didn't know about his path to comedy. And that is all revealed in the following podcast. As usual, this podcast is brought to you by Republic Wireless, the unofficial sponsor. They sponsor, they just don't know that they're sponsoring. If you're looking for affordable cell phone service, if you have a child, if you have a parent who's not going to be Facebooking, or you don't want your child to be Facebooking, or you don't care if they do or they don't, Republic Wireless has plans as low as $10 a month, all the way up to your standard $80 a month plans. You can get a plan that only has call and text, which is what I prefer. I don't need the Wi-Fi. I don't need the 4G data. They're charging $20 a gig some places for data. I'll use the Wi-Fi when I get somewhere. Other than that, I'll download the stuff that I need when I'm on Wi-Fi. And when I'm out in the world, I just need calls and texts. I don't need to be bothered by the distractions of the interwebs. Go to my site, adriancosby.com, or you can visit cosbycomedy.com, or you can visit adriancosby.podbean.com, or you can visit rentboy.com. Wait, no, that's not. I'm not there anymore. I'm not there. Visit my website, guys. Click on the banner for Republic Wireless. Take a look at their phone plans. They have new phones coming out. They have affordable phones. They have great phones, great packages. I want to talk about Ooh shirts again. That's the people that print my t-shirts, and I want to give them a shout out. If you have any merchandising ideas for a t-shirt, go to ooshirts.com and start designing today. You can get your shirts in as small a quantities as 24, and at that, they're still going to be about $5 a shirt. You know, as long as you're not doing crazy designs, and even if you are, they'll quote you a price right there, and they'll show you a proof before you order it. Totally hands-on, guys. It's worth just playing with if you ever had a t-shirt idea, or maybe you just want to design a shirt to support your favorite club or organization. You can still order just one. Visit ooshirts.com, start designing today. If you have car service needs, guys, I use Midas. I use the Midas on Airway in Dayton, Ohio. I love those guys. I never get more than what I want. They give me exactly what I want. They give me the quote. It's speedy. It's friendly. I don't have to worry about them trying to upsell me muffler tips for $80. You know, if I need my muffler replaced, I just get the muffler. I don't need the super expensive muffler. I want the basic OEM muffler. Go to Midas, guys. Stop messing around. All right, let's get into this podcast with Aaron Evans, Wiley's comedy joint manager. Have a good weekend. Enjoy. Okay, welcome to Totally Unrelated. I'm sitting here at Wiley's Comedy Joint, Dayton, Ohio, with the manager, Aaron Evans. I first met Aaron we were both comics. I think we started at about the same time.
Yeah.
And I'd seen you here at Wiley's before, but the first time I really noticed you, me and John Craig went and did a show down the street from Crackers. There was like an open mic at some bar. Jackie Pollock used to book it. I don't know if it's still going or not.
No, that was the old beer cellar show.
Yeah, that's what it was.
I remember that.
And you came down, and we're like, oh, are you on the show? And you're like, nope, just came down to hang out. We're like, how, you live close? And you're like, nope. It's about a two-hour drive. And I was like, damn, he's just like us. And I was like, cool.
Yeah, we have the same sickness, man.
Exactly. Like, I'll drive just to watch a show. Or me, like, I'll lose my teeth just being at a festival.
You never know what's going to happen,
it's,
man.
It's full combat comedy. So you've been manager here of the club for how long now?
13 and a half months. Our, wow. Our one-year anniversary is on October 1st.
Wow.
And that flew by, man. I'll tell you what, that went by quick.
Yeah, it's funny because I don't even think of it as being it seems like it was just a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's weird. I worked with Todd McComas a couple times in the last month.
Good. Todd's
and,
a good guy.
Yeah, so nice. So nice. And I felt like he was a large part of because I just got booked here in January. I'll be here featuring in January.
For who?
Kostaki.
Oh, that's going to be cool.
Yeah. And what's funny is the last time I worked here as a feature was for Kostaki like 2.5 years ago.
Yeah, and Karen's going to be the host that weekend, so you're going to have a lot of fun.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It's the circle of life, which is funny because the last podcast I recorded in this building was with Karen. So, yeah. I'll have to try and get Kostaki to do a podcast.
Absolutely.
It'll be a three-way. What's the biggest difference that you... What's the biggest difference between being a manager of a comedy club and being a comedian?
For me, when you're a comedian, when you're just a comedian at the club, there's a lot less pressure on you. There's a lot less stuff you have to handle during the course of the hour and 45 minutes the show's going on.
Right.
You know, when you're the host, you can bring the feature up and go into the green room for half an hour and talk to the headliner. You can't do that when you're a manager. You have servers to look after. You have to, you know, get bev naps if they're out. There's just so much other stuff going on that you have to take care of rather than just... being the MC and go and talk to people after the show and hanging out with the headliner after the show and all that stuff, you're constantly pulled in all these other directions.
Is it, you know, like when you're about to perform and you're kind of like in your own head, or like you're maybe like it's a big show or you're under putting yourself under pressure as a performer, and then you get better at that over time. As you know, the more shows you do, the more like you're able to not be as nervous
right.
and stuff like that. But it's still kind of like the nuanced noise that's going on in your head. So that sounds to me like what you're dealing with constantly, except it's other people
sure.
in your head
sure.
as a manager.
And it's not quite that bad. The stage fright I get for going on stage is a lot worse than what I get as a manager, because here I have really good staff I'm working with. I have a great team who a lot of the time don't really need me for much. You know,
right.
they know what to do and they have it handled. So for the most part, it's not really that much pressure. A buddy of mine asked me the other day, he's like, he used to be a manager of a comedy club also. And he said, do you still panic when stuff just breaks down? And
right.
you know, some shit hits the fan sometimes when you're around the club and you got to make a quick decision. He's like, do you ever panic in those decisions? I was like, I never really panic. I was like, I don't really get flustered in those situations. It kind of, if you take it easy and you keep an even head and don't get too excited and just try to make good decisions, it'll all even out really well. Especially when you have a staff as good as we have here, there really isn't anything that we can't handle. So the fear of being a manager is a lot less than the fear of going up on stage.
Yeah, I'd say it's a lot easier. Well, not easier. What's the word? It's much more common for a comedian to lose control of an audience than it is for a manager to lose control of his customers.
I agree.
You know what I mean? Because
yeah.
like an audience will mutiny on the comedian, but they won't mutiny against, I mean, occasionally, you know, you'll see like that biker bar shootout that
something,
happened.
Yeah, something you know, has to go really wrong.
Yeah,
though.
But like it's like society still has relatively normal set of standards for for like what we're gonna do in an anarchy situation, and that doesn't usually happen. I'm not gonna say I haven't heard of it happening, but it doesn't usually happen.
It hasn't happened here yet, so I can't complain.
Then you're doing something right. I I love
what this place has done by cutting half the room off with the curtain.
Yeah, that's something that all of the old Wiley's headliners who have come through now under our management, they love that.
Yeah.
They're like, this is every comedy club in America needs this. Like, this is awesome.
I just got done helping construct, my help was like less than 1%, but I've been working for the last few months building the new Funny Bone in Liberty Township.
And
it's
really?
So huge. It's so huge, and it's like three tiers. And what the first thing I thought when I walked in there was they could use a curtain like this to cut off the extra space when they're not using it. It's just
sure
because a small room is you know, when a small crowd in a big room seems so depressing.
Yeah, I agree.
And in a small crowd in a small room, it's like nobody's the wiser.
Yeah, I mean, the room seats 200 people. We can fit 100 of them in front of the curtain, so it splits it about half and half. And I'll tell you what, if you get 75 people packed in here in front of the curtain, it's bananas in here.
Yeah,
it really does make a big difference.
Absolutely. And I've been in here for sold-out shows before, and it's electric for that as well.
Yeah.
But, like, you don't even think about it. Like, I come in now, and I don't even think about the space back.
You don't think about it. It's funny, because I've had customers come in and say, didn't this place used to be bigger?
Yeah.
Like, what happened? And there's also headliners who haven't been here before who didn't know it was a curtain all weekend long until, like, second show Saturday. Like, what is that? Oh, my God, there's more seats back there.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, man, it's a really cool little feature we have.
That's awesome. Who's who's filled this up since you've been here?
Bobcat Goldthwait, Ryan Singer, Chris Bowers, Tom Green, there's some more, but I can't think of them.
Yeah.
There's been probably about 10 of them, I think,
that
we've had to open the curtain for and put people upstairs.
That's nice.
Yeah, it is. That's a really cool feeling. Now, didn't you used to manage like a restaurant or a club or something like that?
I used to be a pizza manager for Donato's Pizza, which is like a Ohio chain. And they're in other states now, but they were primarily just in Ohio when I started, and they started franchising. So I did that for, like, right up until the time that I started doing comedy.
Okay.
In fact, I think I did my first open mic in the town that I was – I was working in Springfield, and I found out about an open mic in Springfield from people I was working with.
Yeah.
And I sent the email from my work computer to Dave Glarden, who's a local guy here in Dayton, who was running that open mic, and the first night I went there, Dan Swartout was the headliner, Gary Offel was one of the comics I met, and there might have been another guy there that I can't remember exactly, but it was funny, it was very surreal, because the whole time I was there, I was like, you know, like your first open mic, and it's not even in a comedy club, it was in like a Holiday Inn bar, and the Holiday Inn was pretty depressed at that point. I think it's like independently owned and under different, it's like Holiday Day or something like that. It's not Holiday Inn anymore. And it was just very surreal, because I remember listening to Dan Swartout, who's a professional comic. He's going to be on the show in a couple of weeks. Talk about having been a road comic and not making any money and wanting to come back home and raise a family and stuff like that, and he wasn't going to be able to do that as a road comic. And I was thinking, like, you know, do you know what this is? It's the world's smallest violin. And I was just thinking to myself, like, you know, and I was like, oh, he must not be that funny, and da, 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 da. And so then all the open micers go up, and I did pretty well for my first time. In fact, he even came up to me. He was like, was that really your first time? And I was like, yeah. And he was like, dude, stick with it. You got something. And after I was so, like, in my own head, like, that I couldn't really process that at the time he was telling me. Then he goes up a few minutes later, and it was one of the best performances I had ever seen live.
He was here on Saturday. He was headlining the family comedy show that we were doing here Saturday afternoon. And I mean, it takes a very skilled comic to be able to do a family clean comedy show with kids as young as 8 years old in the audience and just run them right over. He just killed.
It's one of those things that when you're watching it in the moment, you're not consumed with, this is funny for clean comedy. It's just funny.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And he's a real performer. In fact, I can say this. He has been the biggest influence in advances that I've made in my comedy career.
Really?
He's gotten me in with more bookers than anybody that... I mean, like, I've had comics individually get me in with one booker. He's gotten me in with, like, five.
Good.
And it's one of those things where I wasn't asking him to. You know what I mean? He was just like, dude, you've really come a long way. So he basically took me from my first open mic to even now.
That's really cool.
I mean, it's just amazing. You don't really get that in a lot of different fields. I think you've got a vendor behind you.
Okay, give me 1 second.
No problem.
Yeah, I had never even written a check before I got this job, before I started training. First time I ever wrote a check was at Morty's when I was training. I'd never written checks before.
Like you didn't even have a checking account?
I had a checking account.
But for your debit card.
Yeah, yeah. I'd never needed to actually write the checks. I have a box full of checks at home that I'd never use. It's just, that's just one of the things that you open your mind to when you're taking on a totally different job like this.
Absolutely. That's definitely what I think. I think what made this is the weird part about it is, as a comedian that performs in mostly restaurants and bars, as a former manager, I can tell very quickly when something's running well or when something's not running well. And something's run well in spite of their poor management. You know what I mean? Sometimes you just have a good base of people that keep the wheels on the bus, and sometimes you have less than good employees and a great manager that keeps the wheels on the bus, and sometimes it's just kind of effortless.
Yeah.
This seems more like it's on the effortless end, but I can honestly say that there's a huge difference in performance of speed of drinks being refilled, servers and everything like that. Performance is up. From when I
you're
first
the first
here.
Person I've had tell me that.
Yeah.
And I'm not exactly sure why that is.
Yeah, I think it's just sometimes new blood.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And I think part of it was because it was getting to the point there near the end of Rob's ownership where the club was just depressed.
Yeah.
And business was very poor, and I think they knew that, and they kind of felt that. And that attitude kind of wore off on them a little bit. So,
for sure. Yeah, because they're the front line.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So here comes this new ownership who's coming in and changing stuff and giving stuff a fresher look and bringing in new customers. So the place is busier now. Here's a new full food menu for you guys now to sell food. And, you know, that and just a positive attitude that really, you know, breeds a whole new life into the club.
Yeah.
And that I'm really happy to see that.
Yeah, I think it's a positive change. And I also think that, you know, for whatever reason, near the end, it was... Like, I remember when I found out, I was like, what? But obviously, it was, like, in negotiation for a while.
Yeah.
Some people were in the know. And I think that when, like, as... Not that Rob, I mean, fantastic comic, but definitely was managing on a shoestring when he had it, you know?
Yeah.
And he was like, you know, it's hard to put any money in if I'm not making any money. And that's all this place really needed was, like, kind of, like, an influx and some updating.
Yeah.
And just the way you guys handle... ticket sale or, you know, drink sales and stuff like that at the table and updated all the software and the stage and the steps not being right up front and painting the wall and the curtain and everything. I mean, there were things that could have been done, but I think it took a kind of like, because the owners have multiple clubs, they're drawing on the experiences of simultaneous experiences.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It's like, it's like we know what we like in our clubs.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing when you're like, I want to build a club that's my home, you know, and I think this was kind of Rob's home.
Yeah.
And that's tough for a real working comic, someone who's been in the business that long, because anytime you've been in any job that long, you become jaded.
Yeah.
You know?
And he actually does deserve a lot of praise, because he owned and managed this club alone since 2000.
Yeah.
So that's 14 years he owned the club through the worst parts of the recession, through all this stuff. It was just him. There were no partners who were giving him money whenever he needed it. It was just him, and he made it work for 14 years. And he was telling me, he's like, you know, I was never cut out for this. I just wasn't cut out to be an owner. I was like, Rob, you had open for 14 years.
Yeah.
That's impressive in any small business.
That'd be impressive if we were talking about a marriage.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, tell me about it.
14 years, how'd you do it? Yeah, through the recession?
Yeah.
But that's what's supposed to get you. But yeah, no, I think this is awesome. And when I found out you were going to be the manager, I remember thinking, like, oh, yeah, one of my boys is getting in there. But it's been one of those things where I feel like the clubs were never at odds with each other here in Dayton, I don't think.
I don't think so either.
But I think they're even better off now
yeah.
than they were before. So
Absolutely. They've both turned into really really welcoming clubs that welcome in the young comics, welcome in the comedy scene here.
And I think that's what's most important. I think that's why Dayton, I've heard other people say that like Dayton's the best place to start doing comedy. And I obviously I haven't tried to start doing comedy in every city in the country, sure. But what I can say is great about starting, having started here, was having two clubs in a smaller market where, not to say it's not competitive, but you can get on stage at a major club once a month at least if you're trying, you know, and it may take a considerable amount of effort, but in a major city that can be elusive.
Sure, and even if you're not performing, you have two clubs in town who let comics in for free, and comics are always welcome to come hang out and watch the show, and just, they're just so welcoming. That's a big deal. They don't have that other comedy scenes.
Well, I think in a lot of other scenes, too, like some clubs that might have one club that's there to kind of nurture the talent, and one club's like, we don't do guest spots. We just bring in comics and send them out, you know?
Yeah.
And both these clubs are developing, have always been, I know Doc has always had the belief that developing comics is part of his job.
Absolutely.
And I think that that's what Rob always had too. In fact, the first time Rob ever booked me for a show, he said, I didn't hear your set, but I could hear the audience responding to your set. He's like, so give me a call on Wednesday. I'm going to give you a shot. And that was like, the greatest moment of my life. You know what I mean? Like, because it was like, he was like, I don't even care what you said.
Yeah.
He's like, I care how they react. And that was like, wow. And that's, you know, I've done showcases in Chicago at clubs that where I've done very well, and they may say nice set.
Yeah.
You know, management might say nice set. Good job. But it's, there's no like, I don't even have the illusion that somebody's going to come up and be like, wow, that was really good. You know, because they see the best all the time.
Yeah.
It's like there's no... I remember I was standing in line at the Laugh Factory to do the open mic the following week, 3 minutes. And I'm getting belittled by one of the interns there. It was like, I was talking to this girl, and it was Michelle. And we were just talking because we're standing in line for like 2 hours. And just to sign up. And they make you stand online outside, so it's like creates a buzz, right? I mean, people are walking by like, why is everyone standing online? And this guy, like, people are trying to go in the building, and the doors are locked. And but the door all the way to the far right by the box office is unlocked. And so she says to like five people in a row in like a 5 minute span, because it's getting close to the time. Door on the far end's unlocked, and they'd be like, oh, thank you. And somebody would try to come in at the closed door where we're standing, and she'd be like, door at the far end's unlocked. This dude walks up. And he pulls on the door and it's locked. And I was like, the door on the far end is unlocked. And he turns around and gives me this look like, like you fucking peon piece of shit open micer. And pulls his key out of his pocket and unlocks the door. And I was like, And so Michelle, who's, you know, she's not a veteran comic, but it's no stranger to Chicago and like being kind of like, I think, a rough and tumble type of person.
Yeah.
Starts just like, wow, what a fucking douche. You know, like, wow, that was the douchiest fucking look I've ever fucking seen. I'm like, shh, we gotta sign up still. I don't want him to spit on our spot. I don't know what you do. It wasn't like we were ordering food. But then, like, 2 or 3 minutes later, they all come outside. All the interns and the people that are running the show come outside. And they start talking about how last night Dave Chappelle was in and how amazing it was. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, like, I'm from the same town as this dude. You know, I just saw him last week too, but it was in a coffee shop in my hometown. And I'm here to do an open mic for three. It was just like a huge.
Yeah.
And like, and I didn't like, now if that had happened to me in Dayton, you know what I mean? Like I would have said something to the dude, but I also wouldn't have been standing in line to do a 3 minute open mic
exactly.
for 2 hours or whatever. So it was one of those things where it was like, it truly is a matter of, this is what's different about being a manager and being a comedian, is that as a manager, your age is your age. As a comedian, the amount of time you've been doing it is your age.
Yeah.
So if you've been doing it a year, you're basically like a 1 year. You're still shitting in your pants, essentially. Yeah. And
that is very true.
And at that point, I was like, I'm like a 5-year-old. This guy's an intern. That's the only power he probably has over me is the fact that he has a key in his pocket and he works at the Laugh Factory, which – to me, is no kind of advantage in life or as a comedian. But I thought, like, you know, there's a everyone has a chance to shit on somebody below them,
mm-hmm.
or give them that kind of like. And I never want to be that guy who's treating somebody like that.
Exactly, and that tells you a lot about those people when they have the opportunity to shit on somebody and they don't, and they're just really cool.
Which is what I thought was so great about you being a manager here is that I knew it wasn't going to be a situation where you were just going to be shitting on people. Because, like, you know, there's a lot of managers that would take – a lot of comedians that would take a manager position and also do that.
Yeah.
But I don't think that that's the norm.
Yeah, we had Ari Shaffir, like, our second weekend ever open here.
He
was talking to Bowers after the show, and he's like, and Bowers telling him that I'm a comic also. And Ari's like, you guys can't have comics running comedy clubs. He's like, it's not going to work. He's like, comics will fuck it up. He's like, comics, they'll either steal or they'll just piss everybody off. You can't trust comics running a club. Bowers like, oh, yeah, we can, yeah, we can, yeah, we can. And, you know, here we are a year later, and nobody's caught me stealing anything yet. And fucking nobody who I've bitched at complains. Yeah. They're a bunch of dummies, Adrian.
Comics are also the owners, you see, so they can't catch you. Yeah. No, I agree with Ari in his premise, except for the fact that there's no hard, fast rules. It's like saying rape jokes are never funny. Mm-hmm. And it's like, rape is never funny.
No.
A joke is, by nature, is funny.
Sure.
But I liked Ari. I love Ari's podcast. Ari's one of those guys that I like his podcast more than I like him or his comedy. But I don't dislike him or his comedy. I just really like his interview style. I like what he's kind of a stand for creativity.
Yes.
And I think he's a little bit blue for my taste in comedy. Mm-hmm. But I came and I watched when he was here on Thursday night. And was very impressed with his ability to perform.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which, under the conditions that he performs under. Like, when I saw him, he was like he looked like he was like.
He was having a good time.
Yeah. And but, like, his thing that he does with Shroomfest, and also the fact that he used to be a poker player, and just, like, a lot of just parallels that I see between him and myself.
Yeah.
But also, he's Orthodox Jew, converted to atheist, which is not something I ever experienced. Did you have any religion before you got into comedy?
I had ditched the religion a few years before I got into comedy. Yeah. I think I let that go when I was about 14 or 15 years old.
Yeah.
But before then, I was raised in a family that was fundamentalist Christian.
Ah, that's a big difference.
Which is the most dangerous kind, I might add.
Really?
But, yeah, my grandpa was a pastor, and just both sides of my family, as far as you can trace them back, they're all fundamentalist Christian. They don't drink, they don't smoke, they don't have tattoos, nothing. So it's as straight laced of a place as you can come from. And I wound up in this sinful hole that I'm in. There are two sex shops down the street. I'm running a bar, like, all hell's breaking loose.
This whole place is covered in semen. I mean, the whole Oregon district is just one semen canal.
Yeah, so God only knows what my parents are thinking. But yeah, I came from a very religious place, but.
Are you still good with your family?
Yeah.
They're not you haven't been excommunicated?
No, not by any means.
Is that a practice in the religion that you come from, or is it like?
It's a practice in the religion, but I don't think my family would
do
that.
Could hold up to that. Yeah. And that's funny because I've seen, in one of my quests, I've had over 40 jobs, and one of my quests while I was working all these different jobs was, like, I wanted to get something that was kind of like being a stand-up comic, you know, as good as being a stand-up comic, before I ever decided, why don't you just try to be a fucking stand-up comic? You
know, yeah.
That'd be easier.
Yeah.
And one of them was being a window cleaner. And that was awesome because you'd go to a spot, you'd do 15, 20 minutes worth of work, and then you're off to the next gig.
Yeah.
And you're self-managing. It's fun. One of the places I cleaned as a window cleaner was the Funny Bone. And it had a lot of glass, so you're there for a long time. But I remember cleaning the glass there, and I didn't think I'm supposed to be here as a comedian, not a window cleaner.
Yeah.
But I had that revelation later with other jobs and things that I was doing. But the company was owned by Jehovah's Witness, and they were very Orthodox, very devout, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. The guy that trained me was almost anti-fun. You know what I mean? Like, it was so hard for me to get him to laugh at anything. And I remember when I finally quit, it was before, like, my training period was over. And I just realized, like, when I was sitting there with him, I was like, these guys are so unhappy. I was like, I could never fit in here. Like, I'm not this unhappy.
Yeah, that's just soul-sucking, being around people like that when you don't feel like that yourself.
Yeah, and for me, I don't know how they experienced it, because I think that to them it was just, this is the world that we operate in, but it was like a giant group think. And in a way, it was sort of like being, if you only surrounded yourself with comedians, you would have a very distorted sense of humor.
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah. A lot of things that general people wouldn't find funny, you'd be like cracking up at, and you wouldn't understand, why isn't everyone laughing at this? But it was one of those things where it was like, they were like kind of tiptoeing around whether or not they should continue to employ me or fire me or whatever. And I was like, if this is that discussion, I can go ahead and tell you right now, I quit.
Yeah.
Going to work out. And they're like, well, can you go back to your old job or whatever? We don't want you to be out on the... They basically just didn't want me to file unemployment. Mm-hmm. And I was like, which I didn't. But even when it came down to getting my last check from them, it was like jumping through hoops for $400. It was like...
Yeah.
It showed me that religion has nothing to do with integrity or being a good person.
That is very true.
But I think it kind of has people feel that way. And that's why they stick with it. Or maybe it's just normalcy. You know, I don't know.
I'm not sure what the answer to the riddle is, but I think what you said, that's a really good point. And there are people, I think, like, a lot of people are realizing now that, you know, religion doesn't mean you're a good person.
Right. And that's not to say that because you're religious, you're not a good person.
Right.
It's just they're not mutually exclusive.
Exactly.
You know? They don't go hand in hand. Like, as a fundamental, growing up fundamentalist, at what age did you start questioning?
I think I was 14.
Yeah, and it was pretty quick from there.
Yeah, because all you have to do is once you stop and really think about it, it all goes out the window really quickly.
Yeah.
But the religion I was brought up in trains you not to stop and think about it.
That's the ultimate sin.
Yeah, it's undying loyalty, and you believe without question, and that's just the way it is. And when you're raised with an entire family of people who all think that way, you're not compelled to sit down and wonder, hey, this doesn't add up. You know, what's the deal with this part over here?
Right.
You know, you don't think to have those thoughts. So yeah, it was literally. I was 14 and I was on the school bus one morning and I just started thinking about stuff and, you know, really thinking about the stuff, and it all just fell apart really quickly. I was like, hey, this is bullshit, guys. Yeah. Like, this isn't right.
I just thought about this.
Yeah.
That's funny. What age were you, like, thinking about comedy? Like, started thinking about, like, I think I want to maybe try doing this.
I think I was 17.
Really?
Yeah.
No real... Were you a fan of stand-up before that? You've not been... Okay,
so... I was a huge fan of watching stand-up comedy.
Who was your first favorite comedian?
I loved Craig Ferguson. I thought he did a wonderful job with The Late Late Show.
I thought so, too.
That show was my favorite Late Show. Yeah. Nothing else trumped that. Not Leno, not Jimmy Fallon, not David Letterman. Craig Ferguson was just so different. And he felt so much more genuine with the stuff that he was doing than everybody else did. He wasn't sitting there and reading the questions in his interviews off a card. So he tore up his first card and always threw it over his shoulder before he started interviewing somebody. So there's no card. You know, all of the gags he did. He seemed like he was really tickled by his own jokes and stuff when something was really funny. I really connected with him, and he was like my favorite. So that was the first show, which I wasn't allowed to watch, by the way. but I was watching it, and it was wonderful. And I was like, I'd love to be that.
You know,
he comes out doing this monologue and doing stand-up and getting laughs, and that was great.
I was asleep. I didn't really get into him or realize how funny he was until he hosted Shark Week.
Oh, really?
And I wasn't even into Shark Week, right? But it was like, I was like, isn't that late night dude?
Yeah.
And I knew he was a comedian, but I don't think I was really doing comedy at that point yet, so... But I watched it with my wife, and we were dying laughing. Like, this dude is fucking hilarious.
Yeah.
And I think that's, like, what you were saying about his show being so much different. It was the most authentic.
Yeah.
And it was intimate.
Yeah,
it was. You know what I mean? It's like his fans were fans of him, not fans of late-night television. And you had to really be a fan of him to tune in for that show.
Yeah, and it was funny because it's on at, you know, 12:30 in the morning, and nobody knows about it, and he's making fun of how crappy the lighting is because they don't have any money to pay for new lighting, and it was all just so fun and genuine. I really enjoyed that.
I thought it was, yeah, it had a lot of inside jokes too. What do you think of the new guy that took over for their job?
I haven't seen a single episode of him yet.
Really?
When I'm up that late, I'm not watching TV. I'm here.
Yeah, that's true.
So that's been hard.
I haven't like really studied it, but I've seen some of the clips and stuff, and he reminds me of sort of like a British gay Jimmy Fallon.
Okay.
So I guess I could just say a British Jimmy Fallon, but it's not that there's anything wrong with that.
Not at all.
It's just he is genuinely funny.
Good.
Like a funny dude, not just for the camera.
Yeah.
You know, like he's like he would hang out. Like one of the compliments I give people who aren't comedians is, you know, if you were hanging out with me and my comedian friends, nobody would not think you were a comedian. They just mm-hmm. assume you were.
Yeah.
And like some people are like, wow, thanks, man. You know, and other people are like, oh yeah, cool. Like, I think that's a compliment.
They don't realize how deep that is, man.
And it's really deep because if I had met comedians and they had said that to me, I would have been like, well, take me with you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like I think I was just waiting my whole life for somebody to like give me access to comedy and I would have run with it. I think it was good that I didn't find the access until I was much older, because I don't think I would have survived some of the pitfalls,
yeah.
You know, and some of the vices that other people get caught up with.
Yeah, so I think the first time I ever started writing, I was 17, and then I wrote for 2 years, and I was 19 when I did my first set here.
Wow, so writing for 2 years,
yeah.
Before you sought an open mic, or if one had presented itself before that, would you have joined?
I first sought them out when I was 18, because when you're 17, you can't get into any bars or clubs or anything like that. But when you're 18, you know, you can kind of bend the rules a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So when I was 18, I attempted to. My parents wouldn't let me.
Mm.
They wouldn't let me do it. So I was forced to write for another year, and I worked out a deal with my parents. Okay, since I'm not allowed to go do it by myself, what if I take my sister, my older sister, and her fiance at the time? They're like, yeah, that's fine if you take them with you. So those two came with me here my first time I ever did a show. That was like my little – that was my guideline.
That
my
what year gave. Was that?
That was 2011 maybe?
Well, do you remember the date?
Yeah, it was January 16th. It was in January. It was the day before – there was a holiday, like the day before – I don't remember what it was, like Martin Luther King Jr. It wasn't Martin Luther King Jr. Day, but some before some holiday. So it's a Sunday before. The place is packed.
Because there's a Monday holiday.
Yeah.
You work on Monday.
So – and, yeah, I was 19. I did my stuff, and I had no idea what I was – it's tough looking back at it. It's tough doing material – you've never ever done before.
Yeah, yeah.
And when it's your first time, you haven't done anything before. I'd never tested out jokes on anybody.
Yeah.
So I had no idea what joke's going to work and what wasn't going to work. And I went up there. I did my 5 minutes. I totally missed light because I wasn't looking at it. I was looking down the entire time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And everything went well except the closer. The closer just didn't have a punchline. I didn't realize it. So the closer just completely died. And when that happened, I was on stage. And in that moment of seconds, I thought it was all falling apart. I thought, oh God, I fucked it up.
Yeah,
this is all ruined now.
I'll never be back.
Yeah, I was doing so well, and the most important part's the closer. I messed it up, and that happened. And I said, okay, well, that's it. I'm Aaron Evans. That's my time. And they fucking lit up, and they started cheering like I hadn't told a bad joke.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that brought me back from the edge. It's like, okay, this is cool now. I'm back.
That's hilarious, because he totally just illustrated something I try to explain to comics. This guy I was talking to was here a couple weeks ago, and he was outside. He wasn't asking for advice, but sometimes I feel like I need to tell people what other people won't tell them.
Yeah.
And especially because I could tell he wasn't going to quit anytime soon. He started, his opening joke was about, you know, anal something, this or that, and anal fisting or something like that. And I was just telling him, I was like, look, let me give you a piece of advice. I'm not going to tell you to drop the joke. I'm just going to say that it's harder and easier when you're first starting, because you don't know what's good and what's bad. All you have to do is compare what you've done thus far. So in your first set, you'll be like, this is going good, this is going bad, this is going good, this is going bad, like up and down. And so like, you were doing good, and then you dropped that last joke, and suddenly you're like, oh, shit, this is the end of my career. And then you said, you know, good night, and they're like, yay, and you're like, okay, I'm back.
Yeah.
You know? Now, if you expand that over 10 years, the ups and downs become much more of a flat-looking line.
Yes.
But in your first performance, those peaks and valleys are like
it's quite the ride.
Yeah, it's fucking the beast.
Yeah.
And so that's what I was telling him. I was like, you'd be better off preparing two different sets. One that's completely squeaky clean that could pass any censor, not because it doesn't have cuss words in it, but because the subject matter is clean, not anal. Mm-hmm. I was like, if you're at an open mic and the room is packed and you go up first, second, or third and open with anal, you're not going to get a good response.
Right.
It's just too early in the show.
Mm-hmm.
You let somebody else break the ice. Maybe somebody that's better at it or somebody that's worse at it. But, you know, if you had done that show and you were going second or third from the end, it could have got a completely different response just because of where you were in the show.
Yeah.
I was like, so consider where you are in the lineup for what kind of jokes you're going to do. And I know this is like your third or fourth show, so you don't have that much material. But I found that when I was first starting, I was able to generate a lot of material because I didn't have much scrutiny on myself.
Right.
You know, like, this is the kind of joke I would do. This is the kind of joke I wouldn't do. I didn't even know who I was as a comedian yet. So it was like, I could write anything.
Yeah.
Now, you know, 5-6 years in, I'm like, I'll write the joke and I'll give it away to somebody that would do it. You know, but at the time, like, I've got notebooks full of shit that I don't even like to read. So it's like, why would I go back and read my own stuff? But it's like, when I go through there, sometimes I only get in like a half a page before I'm like, oh my God, I was writing way ahead of my time. You know, so I think that's one of those situations where your first time on stage is your whole career in like a droplet of water.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like you don't even realize you're about to put that droplet into a river.
Exactly.
But it does feel like all the weight of the world is on you. So you did that. So that was, I started in 2011, but I didn't start till March.
Okay. Well, we were really close then. Yeah. Holy cow.
Yeah. Yeah. Because if you were near Martin Luther King, if that was it, or even Valentine's Day, those are both in February, aren't they?
Yeah. Yes, you're right.
So, or actually Martin Luther King might be at the beginning. I don't know. I'll edit that part out. Black guy saying he don't know what Martin Luther King's birthday is.
Yeah.
But yeah, I remember the first time I saw you here, and I remember thinking, like, good Lord, this guy's a beast. And it was very stoic. You know, you're just kind of like staying in one place.
Yeah,
the one-liners.
I was wearing black clothes at the time, wasn't I?
Yeah.
I remember that.
And the hair, dude, like, just the hair, growing hair out makes you look younger than it did when you had your head shaved.
Yeah.
How tall are you?
6'5".
6'5".
Without any hair.
Yeah. That's crazy. You look like you were 6'7" without any hair.
And 30.
Yeah. Yeah, and
you were the one who was telling me that stuff. You're the one who's like, you know what? He's like, you don't look bad, but you know, you gotta. How about you get something?
Well, your act was so smart, and so I think I remember saying, I was like, you'll get exponential laughs if you dress for your act,
right?
And I felt like your act was very, not necessarily suit and tie, but definitely jacket.
Yeah.
Material,
not just black turtleneck and black combat boots.
Yeah. Combat boots for a comic is almost one of those things where you kind of have to explain yourself pretty quickly. You know what I mean? Like, so like DJ Dangler comes up on stage, he's like, bah, rah,
yeah.
You know, he's like, you know, and it's like, yeah. You don't have to explain anything else, buddy. We get it. We get it. And that's he was the one actually that kind of gave me that paradigm shift where I realized, if you can let the audience know who you are before you even touch the microphone, you're winning.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because otherwise you're wasting stage time trying to explain to them who you are, and they can't really laugh at you until they know who you are. It's one of those things where it's like, if you walk into the bank and just start talking to everybody, people are like, who's this motherfucker?
Yeah.
But if you're like, I'm the owner of the bank, nice to meet you, then they're like, oh, he's the owner of the bank. He's nice to meet me. It's a completely different experience.
Right. And yeah, that was just that period, which I call my black phase.
Yeah.
But that period of my life was showing my life and experience, because I came from a place where, like that show, I'd never done anything like that in public. I'd never been out in public on that kind of scale before.
Right.
I was homeschooled my entire life. I was in a little fundamentalist Christian town of 5,000 people.
So what would be like a big experience for you before comedy? Like, what was like your biggest highlight of, like, did you go to a concert or like?
I'd never been to a concert.
So church would be like the biggest social gathering.
Yeah, that was what I had to go
off.
Did
you ever speak in front of your church?
No, never.
Was that something other people did? Was it something you aspired to do? Like, I might do it.
No, because I think once I became more mature, I became less interested in church. Yeah, so I didn't really, I didn't think of church that way. Like, oh, I'd like to do that. I'd like to speak like that. I was more kind of put off by the whole thing.
Right.
But yeah, I didn't know, you know, how to dress. I didn't know that having my head shaved made me look weird. I didn't know. I was just so inexperienced in life in general that I didn't know those things.
How long do you think it took you to catch up to life?
I'm still catching up, dude. Like, I still get really nervous when I talk to people. I still stutter sometimes because I get nervous talking to people. I still start talking too fast. I'm still, you know, Bowers, I give Bowers a lot of credit because Bowers has done a really good job of teaching me how to be a human being. Like, Bowers, yeah, that's really true. Like Bowers took me under his wing. I started going to Morey's because he saw a lot of potential, but it wasn't all there yet.
Yeah, yeah.
And he taught me how to talk to people. He taught me, you know, why acting like this makes you seem kind of weird. Why you should maybe try this instead. And Bowers coached me a lot and made me a much better person socially.
Probably, yeah, he's an extreme case of comedian.
Yes.
He's an extreme case of comedian.
He's a comedian through and through.
Yes, but at that same token, like, who better else to coach a young kid? It's not like he's no Sam Kinison.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so it's like, it's not like he's going to give you bad advice. And I think the one thing I can honestly say about Bowers is that if he is doing that for you, it's because he genuinely wanted you to succeed.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And that's the way I felt. And that's why I fell in love with Morey's, because that was the vibe I got from being there. And I had never felt that before at home or at church or anywhere
else. Dude, I've only been to Morey's one time, and I walked in, and he was in the box office and said, "Hey, Bowers, we met one time." He said, "Yeah, at the Funny Bone, Adrian Cosby, right?" And I said, "Yeah." He's like, "Come on in. Come on in. We're going to have a great show." We came in. We watched John Doerr. It was one of the best nights I've ever had watching comedy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it was just a great, he treated us like celebrities, you know, comped all our drinks. And, well, John wasn't drinking, but I got pretty wasted. And I thoroughly enjoyed the show, and I enjoyed the vibe of everything that was happening there. And
yeah.
I thought, like, wow, that's one way to be. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
I almost couldn't believe he was a real person. He's so larger than life.
Yeah, I remember my first time there very clearly. I had it all recorded until somebody stole my damn recorder.
From the back of the room?
Yeah, out of my coat pocket in the back of the room. That sucked. But I had that set recorded, and it was funny because I was 5 months in, maybe, and people ask me why I did Wiley's first. Like, why was Wiley's?
Yeah, that's what I was just about to ask you. Was this closer geographically?
No, I was 2 hours from everything. I wasn't close to anything. I'm in a little tiny town in the middle of Indiana, in the middle of nowhere. So I'm 2 hours from Morty's, and I'm 2 hours from Wiley's. I did Wiley's first because Bowers wouldn't answer my emails. So I did Wiley's first. After about 5 months, Bowers finally got back to me and booked me to do, because he was booking the open mic at the time. So and hosting. So I did the open mic there, and I didn't really sit with anybody before the show because I was a little bit of a loner and still kind of am. I like to kind of be alone and go over my jokes myself and all that. So I didn't really talk to anybody before I went up. And I go up and I do my best material, because my piece of advice to comics that I've given a few times is when it's your very first time performing in some place, always do your best material.
Yeah, yeah.
Every time I go in a new club, I do my best stuff. So I do my best 6 minutes, and I get off. And Bowers takes the stage after I get off stage, still laughing.
Yeah.
And he's like, "Holy shit, that was funny." Aaron Evans, everybody. Give it up for Aaron Evans. Yeah. And after that, he was like, "I want to see you here all the time." He took me into the green room, and Tony, who's his best friend and co-owner of Morty's, sitting there on the couch with his flip-flops on. "Hey, good set, buddy." Like, he's listening to me, too.
Yeah.
And Bowers gave me his phone number and was like, "Start coming to open mic. We do a writer's workshop every Wednesday. Come to the workshop. We work on some jokes. We're going to really tune you up and get you to where you're a joke-telling machine." And I've never felt so welcome before in a place in my life.
Yeah.
And that felt really cool. So then I started going there more regularly. He would let me into shows for free if I wanted to come down and watch a show. And what I would do was I didn't want to go home. I had nothing to go home to. So, like, after the show, I'd hang out with Kevin Hoover and Avery Dellinger, who are the managers there. So I'd just hang with the managers after the show, and I'd kind of tag along with them while they're going through the process of shutting everything down and doing some stuff, where they'd just talk about stuff to me, because I was a guy willing to listen to them talk about their day or whatever.
And so, also, this is all brand new to you.
I know. All of it is.
Yeah.
Because because, I mean, it was just, it was crazy.
You didn't have a job, like, in high school or anything? You weren't in high school, you were homeschooled.
I was a farmer. I was a farmer since the age of 15. I was a farmer. It's the only job I ever had. So you're coming from this farm into this nightlife, which is just a turn in the complete opposite direction. Uh-huh. So you have no point of reference. You're trying to do the best you can, and you're trying not to act like a fish out of water. I felt like that a few times. I didn't want to show that off, but yeah, I didn't know how to talk to people. I didn't know how to properly dress for the job. There's so much stuff. I was a virgin at the time. You know, I didn't know any of this stuff. And here are these people who are like, you know, we'll help you out, buddy. You know, you're welcome here. You come hang out with us, and we're gonna make you have a good time. And that was a lot of fun. And here we are, 2 or 3 years after that now, where I've been here for a year working for them. And it's just, I never would have guessed any of this would have happened. I never would have guessed I'd wind up here, you know, in 3 years after starting out. I never would have guessed that. But I'm really happy. I love it here.
Do you get out to do shows outside of here?
Not really.
No, this takes up a lot of your time.
It takes up a lot of my time. And the biggest problem is, with it affecting my stand-up, a comic here the weekend asked me if I still had time to write new jokes. And I can still get the ideas, write down the ideas, but I don't have time to, like, sit down anymore at the computer and, like, really type stuff out and flesh out ideas and really write jokes. So I can still think of stuff and write the stuff down, but I don't have time to really, like, go in and build a set now. And that's kind of that's hard.
Yeah.
And so I've my goal for the next couple of weeks is, you know, try to find time to do that again. You know, take this, because I haven't written anything worth bragging about in over a year, so I have all this experience.
I was going to say for me ever, but
yeah.
Never bragged. Well, I mean, never in public at least.
Yeah. So I have all this new experience now that I can tell jokes about, and I have all this new stuff I can work on. So I really need to, you know, buckle down again and start hammering away at these jokes and see if I can build a new set. And
I have to say, that's probably the hardest part of ever trying to write a joke, especially you're so young. Not like when you first started, especially, you know, like not even young as a human being, but young at life.
Yeah.
Because all relatable comedy comes from either comes from absurdity or it comes from reality, but mm-hmm. it all comes from, like, an experience with reality and life experience and stuff, which is why I think a lot of the best comedians break at an older age.
Mm-hmm.
It's not because, it's just because they finally have become wise enough to put these thoughts together in a way that's like boom, 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 boom. And a lot of younger comics are funny, but it's more energy than it is well thought out.
Yeah.
And, like, being a restaurant manager will expose you to every type of person.
Yes.
Every type of person that goes out to eat. And I've always felt that people that are hungry and not being served in a way that they felt they should be served,
right,
we're going to be the most honest with you. True, you know, good or bad, they're going to be the most honest with you out of anybody.
Absolutely.
You're ever
and yeah, what you said before about life experience is true, because I came from a place where I didn't have much life experience at all.
Yeah.
You know, I was, at the time when I started comedy, I was 19 and I was a farmer.
Yeah.
And I'd never been to a concert. I'd seen a handful of movies, because we weren't allowed to watch PG-13 movies or above when I was a kid, so I hadn't seen anything. We didn't have a TV until I was like 10, so I never watched TV or anything. So I've been like starting my life from scratch when I'm 19 years old.
Wow.
And you're trying to catch up with everybody else, and that's
also not look like that.
Exactly.
Not look like you're playing catch up.
Exactly. I'm still working on that. I'm still trying to improve myself socially.
Yeah.
That's one of my biggest weaknesses. I'm trying to socially get on the same level as everybody else, because I'm not used to talking to people.
I think you're coming along great, man. Why don't you handle your vendor guy and we'll wrap this up.
That's the one bad thing about doing what I do is, you know, you see some restaurants and stuff, mm-hmm. and they're like your favorite restaurant. And then you're like,
it's
never eating there again. Never. All the time.
Thanks,
there's probably three or four places I won't even eat at that I used to love to eat.
Yeah. Not
even eat there.
Well, yeah, you can't just say that and not tell us what they are, though.
Yes, he is.
Oh, I guess so. Okay, and that's it.
And then that's it. Those Ponderosas that are closed now.
Sizzler.
Sizzler.
I can't do it anymore. They lost the sizzle. Everything just started growing up. The
for vendors. I used to have, when I worked, I had a lot of produce. I dealt with, like, a lot of produce.
Okay.
And, so, like, the different vendors that would come in, I was always so jealous of the people that got to stop at different places and then get in the car and then go.
Yeah.
I got into pizza, into the management from being a pizza delivery driver. And that is what kind of, like, brought me out of my shell. So in a similar way to, like, you being homeschooled, I was in learning disabled classes growing up, so I was in a much smaller classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And also it was, like, one of those things where everybody else in the school knew you had trouble learning.
Yeah.
So it was, like, I grew up with this shadow of feeling slightly retarded. Not even slightly, just that everybody knew I was borderline, basically. Not to use the term retarded in any kind of a derogatory term, like, as in not was mentally challenged, you know? And that's where my comedy came from. You know what I mean? Like, the idea that I'm not smart and everybody knows that.
Right.
And so that's, like, you know, a lot of people say comedy comes from pain or some sort of horror or something like that. But what is your genesis of the comedy, do you think? Where does the kernel of the necessity to turn things funny? Is there some? Have you figured that out yet?
I don't think so. Since the jokes I was doing before I got this job, which are as of right now, are a lot of my same set because I haven't written much that's new. But a lot of my jokes were either something absurd, or it was wordplay,
mm-hmm.
or just something kind of tricky with language that I could do, or maybe something in the news that happened that I could make a joke about. But my act was never really about life experiences at all, because I didn't really have any.
Right.
So I made up for that by just telling jokes, because I felt like I was at a disadvantage, because everybody else was so far ahead of me in life experience. I didn't have anything to really go off of.
So that's an interesting... We'll break that down for a second.
Okay.
What's the difference between Aaron at, say, let's say 16, 17 years old,
mm-hmm.
versus Aaron in his kind of peak of doing shows and doing comedy or whatever? What's the difference between being on stage and being at rest? Do you know what I mean? Like, for me, when I'm on stage, a lot of times I feel more alive than ever.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, more, maybe not more present, but in a way kind of like I'm skydiving and I'm in that, and that is what I'm doing. And when the ground gets closer, that's when I'll know it's time to start doing something else.
Yeah.
But for somebody who didn't have any other, like, you know, I played soccer and I played tennis and I had a lot of, I was good enough that I played for, not that they were all there to see me, but I played in front of crowds.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like, comedy in a large part was just an extension of that.
Sure.
But for somebody coming out of, like, the abyss, out of nothing, to wanting to stand on a stage, what's the difference between being at rest and being on stage?
Being on stage was very frightening. I've always had stage fright really, really bad. It's better now than it was, but it was horrible stage fright. And it was at the time when I was starting out, my first probably year and a half in, it was less of feeling like you were skydiving and more like you were trying to keep from messing it up. Like,
mm-hmm.
I was very afraid of screwing something up and then losing them and having my set go down the toilet. I was more driven by fear and trying to keep it all together.
What would it mean if that happened? What would that mean to you if that happened?
I don't know. I think I was afraid that I wouldn't come back from that. I think I was afraid that I would tank in front of somebody important and the big comedy club business door was going to close in front of me. I thought that's how it worked. I was so much driven by fear and trying to, my head was flying through all these different scenarios, what could happen, and trying to figure out these possible solutions and stuff. So I'm overthinking everything by a mile when I'm on stage, and I'm frightened. So it was kind of a strange mixture. I look back at some tapes now, and I felt like my stage presence was horrible when I was on stage. I didn't look like I was in control. I looked like I was, you know, sheepish a little bit, and I could barely watch my old self. So it was very difficult. It was a very difficult time. It's difficult because I wanted to do it so bad. Like, all I wanted to do was stand up comedy and be a good stand up comic and try to make a living out. Like, that's what was meant for me. And it's hard when you that's an area where you struggle at is public speaking.
Yeah, yeah.
Like when you're scared of speaking in public and you want somebody who speaks in public all the time, well, you got to get over something real quick. Otherwise, it's not going
to
work.
It's like wanting to be a stripper, but you're like, I don't want anyone to see me naked.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's what it felt like. And it still felt like that a little bit. I still get stage fright, and I'm still afraid that I'm going to screw something up when I'm up there, and it's all going to go really south on me. But
you keep doing it.
Yeah, I have to. Because if I stop, when I decided I wanted to start doing comedy, like when I'd written some jokes down and written some stuff, I'm like, okay, I'm actually going to do this now. I watched every single how-to comedy video on YouTube. I did everything I could.
So you took all the bad advice first.
Yes, exactly. And I told myself that I wasn't going to give up on it. Yeah. I was like, because if you try it and it gets hard and you give up, well, that was what are you giving up for? Yeah. You know, stay with this thing and don't let anything knock you off the rails and just keep trying. And that was kind of my attitude. Like, yeah, I'm scared to death up there, but I'm never gonna succeed if I stop.
Yeah.
So I kind of had to force myself to keep going. It's gotten a little better.
So that's what it's like on stage. What's it like coming off immediately after?
Depends how it went. I've never felt like I have had a perfect set before. I always feel like there was at least one little aspect that I could have done better. Yeah. There's one beat there that I missed.
And then do you obsess on those?
For a very short time, okay. Usually until the show's over. Uh-huh. Once the show's, I don't hear the comedian before me or the comedian after me because I'm so deep in my head I don't even hear it anymore.
Yeah.
I'm usually a little shaky still when I get off stage because I'm still so nervous. I'm shaking from it a little bit. And I just kind of go over everything and make sure that I know what mistakes I made, if there were any, and how to correct them next time. So it's still, my heart's still pounding like a motherfucker.
Right.
But I've come down a lot since being on stage. But it's still a good feeling. When you come off stage and you had a really good set, that's awesome.
Yeah.
But I never patted myself on the back too hard and said, oh, yeah, fantastic job, buddy. You're king of the world now. Mm-hmm. No, I kind of knew, okay, you made some mistakes back there. This part here could have been a little bit better. So I tried to keep myself humble as best I could.
That's definitely one thing I think I've always admired about you is you have a healthy dose of humility. And it's one of the things that drives me crazy about a lot of comics. And people might think of me as not being a humble person. But when it comes to comedy, if you ask me, like, how funny do you think you are? And I've never said, you know, I'm one of my favorite comedians.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not. I'm not even close to one of my favorite comedians, and I'm not even close to as funny as I want to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, I know that.
Yeah.
And some people are like, no. I know comics that are actively are their favorite comedians, and their kind of comedy that they do is the only good kind of comedy being done right now. I mean,
sure.
that's a rarity, but I've heard that said, and I don't think it's necessarily wrong. But for me, I've always identified with people who are, you know, like, man, that was a great set. And then they're kind of like,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It wasn't, you know, thank you, but I know it was not a great set. You know, it's like, and then there's other people that you'd be like, man, that was really good. And they're like, you know what I mean? And it was lights out. Chris Allen's one of those guys who, like, will burn the place down. And you'd be like, man, that was great. And he'd be like, I wasn't happy with it. And you're like, you son of a bitch!
Yeah, I know.
I'd kill somebody to have a set like that.
I know. Now, kind of going with that, I do think it's important, though, to have a mentality of kind of like when you're playing soccer, kind of like you have to have this little bit of competitiveness in you.
Sure.
And to where you're like, everybody else better fucking watch out for me.
Yeah, yeah,
you
yeah.
You know, you have to kind of have that little bit of energy inside of you to where you're like, okay, I'm a force to be reckoned with.
Right.
But you don't want to be a cocky dick off stage and make them think that. You know, when you're on the soccer field, you want to have this kind of attitude and this swagger about you, and you want to have this mentality. But I wouldn't take that off stage to be a dick to people.
No, and I think like what you're talking about is just your general presence. And I noticed that once I started doing comedy, I started walking more straight up, less shoulder slump, less looking down in public. And I remember thinking that attractive women were noticing me for the first time in my life. And I don't think that's necessarily true. I just think that they were, with my confidence, I was noticing more people.
Sure.
And when you walk with your head down and your shoulders slumped and you don't look confident, everybody can tell.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yep. And as a comedian, if that's how you are off stage, people will take shots at you. But if you're And not necessarily like shots at you for being not funny or less than or whatever. It's just that you're a target. You know what I mean? Especially if you're hanging out with comics, because comics are sharpshooters. and so I think that's what I try to be in. You know, I don't ever try to bust anybody's balls that can't take it.
Right.
You know, and sometimes you find out after the fact they can't take it. But I like busting balls, and I'm extremely gracious with allowing my balls to be busted. You know what I mean? But like you said, at the same time, you have to always have that kind of like, not superiority, not an air of superiority, but an air of don't fuck, you know.
Yeah,
if you fuck with the bull, you'll get the horns.
Yeah, like, I'm not a nobody.
Yeah, exactly.
Like I'll fucking bring it to you.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that there's also the inherent competition is a healthy thing to keep.
Because
we police ourselves, you know what I mean? It's like there's no comedy police, there's no patent or copyright infringement or anything like that. So if we don't like what somebody's doing, or like there was that thing that was happening at the Dublin Pub where it was supposed to be a clean show and comics wanted to cuss and
right.
stuff like that. And to me it's like, you know, you can't have somebody running a show who can't tell comics no.
Right.
So if you're running a show and you're like, oh, I told you to keep it clean last week, you were filthy, you know, like, well, yeah, I'm signing up again. It's like, no, you're not.
Exactly.
If you can't say that, then you shouldn't be running a show.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a shame when shows go away, especially in this area, but it's not to say that something can't take its place right away.
Exactly.
It's laziness that has there not be more comedy in this area.
Yeah, there are plenty of venues and plenty of owners of those venues who'd be happy to have comedy, I think. But you have to go search for them. You have to go find them and present the opportunity to them as well. So I think there's enough dates without shows and enough people who want to do shows to where if we wanted to make some shows happen here every night of the week, we definitely could.
I'm going to ask you this last question before we get out of here, and it's not so I'll tell you this too. I was going to tell you this yesterday, but I never did. And then the co-guest that I was going to bring with me today was Megan Knight from the Dayton Funny Bone.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the general manager. She said she'd never met you before.
No, so, that's a bummer. I wish she could have made it.
I know. She had her boyfriend or fiance, I don't know what the official title is. I may have to edit that.
her husband.
Yeah, her husband of 6 months. Oh, no! I dropped the ball. Had to go to the hospital. So,
okay.
But she guessed it. I was like, she didn't want to do the podcast alone. And so I was like, okay, well, I'll find somebody, you know. And I was like, hey, why don't we meet at the Oregon District? She was like, are you pairing me with Aaron Evans? And I was like, how did
she's
you
good.
Get that fast?
She I mean, is good, man.
She never texts back that fast. and I was like, I can't even lie. You know, I was like, yeah, that was the goal. And then when you said, can we do it at 11? I said, text her. I was like, can we do it at 11? She was like, sure. And I was like, this is going to be great. And then she texted me this morning saying she didn't know what her schedule was going to be like today because of this hospital thing
sure.
she had to do, which, you know, hindsight being 2020, it would have been great if it had worked out, but I kind of think I'm going to enjoy this episode being just about you because I think your story is very unique.
Thank you.
I want to ask you this about, because there's a lot of talk, and I'm even hearing it from people I didn't expect to hear it from, about the new club opening in Liberty Township and what that's going to do to the Dayton Club and what it's going to do to Wiley's in general. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts or ideas about there being too many clubs between Newport, Kentucky and Dayton or
right.
even Columbus.
Yeah, I honestly don't think the new club will affect us at all. I think that they built that club where they built it to draw from the people who live in the close vicinity of that. There's a very good medium household income in that area. I think they're trying to get a little more of an upper class people in there from that own little area surrounding them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they're trying to pull people from Dayton to go all the way down there to watch a comedy show. You'd have to have somebody pretty spectacular for somebody to drive 45 minutes to a comedy show and 45 minutes back.
Right.
So unless they book Bill Burr or unless they book Louis C.K. or somebody like that, I don't think it'll really affect us that much. I think there are enough people down there who they're targeting that it won't affect us up here.
I agree. And I think that it's if what we are experiencing right now is a resurgence in stand-up comedy, which is what I think we're experiencing.
I've heard that. They say we're in the middle of a new comedy boom now.
Yeah. Then I think that it's a natural
progression to have more clubs spring up.
Yeah.
I do think that it will incentivize competition in the area,
which isn't always a bad thing, by the way.
But it's competition is good for the consumer.
Yeah.
It may not be great for the business owner because it means more work, but it doesn't necessarily mean less profits.
Right.
It just means more creativity is going to be required to maximize those profits. But mm-hmm. I think it's going to be good for comics, and I think it's going to be good for fans of comedy
yeah.
to have that many options. But like I said, I was working there and driving from Dayton out of there. It was
how long is the drive?
At least 45 minutes. I mean, and if you do it, you know, on a Friday or a Saturday night, it's going to be longer. And it's a huge mall, so they didn't build that mall to draw people from Dayton.
Yeah, I don't.
You know what I'm saying?
Because that would hurt their Dayton club. So you know, Stroop's not a dumb guy. He doesn't want to hurt his club by building a new one. He wants to draw people from a different location than he wasn't getting before with either of his two clubs. Because let's say you have two clubs and they're both on each end of these really big spectrum. Well, you're not going to get people who are in the middle there because both clubs are so spread out. So
yeah. Let's
put a club right there in the middle and get that crowd in there as well. Stroop knows what he's doing, and that's a beautiful club. The one in Columbus is beautiful and renovated now, so he knows what he's doing, and they're going to be getting some great comedy at that club down there.
I think it's going to be the flagship, you know, Liberty and Columbus will be the two basically like, you know, major draws. You know, if a guy that's like deciding, do I want to do a theater or do I want to do the club, might opt to do the club, you know, because of the multiple shows and because it seats 400 or whatever like that instead of doing the theater. But like, I think you're totally right. I don't think unless you would drive an hour and a half to see your favorite comic, you're not going to drive 45 minutes just to go to a comedy club tonight.
Exactly, because if you let's say you live in Dayton and you want to go to a comedy club,
right.
You're going to go to probably one of the two that are in Dayton. You're not going to want to drive 45 minutes away because then you can't drink too much because you're going to make that tricky drive home. You know, you want to kind of be somewhere where you feel a little bit safe, where it's easy to get home if you are a little bit intoxicated. So it just, I don't think it'll affect us at all, to be honest.
I'll tell you this: this is the only. The only chess move in this whole, this is the manager, the former manager and former business owner in me, when I see it all, is that when this club was taken over, it could have moved to Springboro or further south. And I think that would have been I'm not going to say that it's doomed because it didn't. You know, there's no fuzzy logic. I just think it would have been an interesting move because I feel like this location, I think the reason you guys haven't rebounded faster is because of the fickleness of some of this area is a very historic area. And so people came, maybe had a bad experience, like, I'll never go back to that club, even under new management or whatever. Maybe they just didn't, they're not even paying attention.
Yeah, I think a lot of it, that's what it is. I think it's been tough to win back some of those customers who had a bad experience before, and they don't know we're under new management now.
Yeah.
They've missed the Facebook posts. They've missed the news articles. So they don't know. They still think it's old wives. They still think it's not going to be that fun.
Right.
But, as far as the new location goes, I was talking to Tony on the phone the other day, and he was like, you know, if we had all the money we ever wanted, we could put it wherever we want. He put it up there at Miller Lane next to the Drury.
He's like, that'd be
such a great area to have the club up there instead.
That's a good spot.
But you know, it's where it is now. And we made our choice, and we're going to – I think it's the right choice. I think this building is beautiful, and I think there's a lot of history here. I think it is in a good part of town. We're in a spot where nobody else has parking. We have our own parking lot. We have a good sound system. It's all set up wonderfully. So if it takes a little while, if the rebound's a little bit slower, you know, but we gave them a good product throughout the whole timeline. Yeah, I'm not upset with that at all.
Yeah, I agree, and I think that that's a great attitude to have, and probably the best note we could even end on. Thank you, sir.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for working on my schedule today. I appreciate you not cutting me off and everything. It's tough to get me alone for 2 hours with everything going on, so I appreciate you working
totally
around me.
I totally appreciate it. I've wanted to do this since I started podcasting. You were one of the first guests I ever wanted to have, so it was like I knew I wanted to interview the people. Like the whole kind of concept for my podcast is these are the people in your neighborhood, which you probably didn't learn that song because you weren't in school.
Nope.
You were homeschooled. But it's like your mailman, your police officer, and it's like who's a stranger, who's not a stranger, and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And my neighborhood of comedy has been paved with really genuine people that I've met that, like,
you would think I've known them my whole life.
Yeah.
But sometimes you meet somebody like at a show, you do a weekend with them or something like that, and you're like, we're lifelong friends now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like you're bonded by the fire of the stage or whatever. So
yeah, I had a blast. I was kind of afraid. I was kind of wanting at the time. I was kind of wanting a co-host because I was afraid I couldn't carry this on my own as one person. I was kind of hoping there'd be kind of somebody else there beside me who could talk. But I didn't have anything else to say. But I think it really turned out really well.
Yeah,
you did a good job with this,
dude. I think you gave us enough insight into your youth and where you are today that. It's going to explain a lot to anybody.
There's a lot that needs to be explained.
Yeah. I mean, we just kind of dusted over the surface of
yeah,
it. But
tell
it was
me
like,
that.
I was sitting there thinking, like, I didn't even know this about you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But when Megan was asking me, she's like, yeah, I've never met him. And I was like, he's one of the nicest people I've ever met in my life. You know, I don't say that a lot about people. And so I was like, so I'm not worried about putting two competing, not even that you're in competition, but two club managers in the same room to talk about
sure.
business or whatever. And I told her, I said, this is, if you had guys done it together, then I would have done it like a disclaimer at the beginning saying that if you guys weren't both completely happy with the product, that I wouldn't air it. You
sure.
know, it'd take both of you guys to say, yes, I like it for it to be finished. And so doing it this way, being able to focus just on you and your story, I think,
yeah. And for the record, if, you know, later on the road we're going to do that episode of the two of us, I'd be more than happy to.
Okay.
You tell me the time and the place, and I'll be there to do that. Absolutely.
Maybe we'll get Mikey and Tony
okay.
and Stroop in the room, too.
We're going to start solving some big problems.
We're
going to...
she whispers.